WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We're going to remember the poet, essayist, and teacher, June Jordan. She died 1 week ago after a long bout with breast cancer. She was 65. She first became known during the Black Arts Movement of the late 60s and 70s. She wrote about civil rights and women's issues. Remembering the Harlem riots, which she witnessed in 1964, she wrote, "I resolved not to run on hatred, but instead to use what I loved, words, to fight for the people I loved." Jordan was born in Harlem and raised in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, by parents who were immigrants from Jamaica. She wrote over 24 books and taught at Sarah Lawrence College, Yale, and the University of California at Berkeley. When I spoke with her in 1989, I asked about her first teaching experience in 1967 at a writing workshop where her goal was to encourage African-American children to trust in their own expression.
What I did specifically was to ask them whatever it was that they wanted to say, just to tell me exactly how they wanted to say it, and I would write it down exactly as they said it in the same, you know, identical syntax to the spoken piece they had given to me. And eventually then they began to write themselves without editing themselves, censoring themselves, and trying to make their language over into somebody else's idea of, quote, English, unquote. And all of this had an enormous effect on me in the context of Black English, and the question of the relationship between language and politics per se. It seems to me that what I'm talking about, and other people who are similarly concerned, is the entitlement of each and every one of us to speak in the language that we learn at home, so to speak, our home language, and not to have that in any way denigrated or punished by someone who speaks in another vernacular.
Now, I understand that there was a book that you wrote or edited, I'm actually not sure which, that Black parents tried to ban because they thought explain what the situation was there.
Yeah,
I only know it sketchily.
That was in 1970, actually. It was a novel that I wrote called His Own Where, and it's the first novel in American literature, per se, that's written altogether in Black English. I mean, everything, you know, not just the dialogue, but the narration as well. And what happened was the different groups of parents, particularly Black parents in Baltimore and Philadelphia and other places like that, really mobilized to get the book taken off the shelves. They didn't want the book available to their children either in libraries or the regular classroom situation. And I began going around meeting with these different groups of parents. I was just astounded. I thought they would be appalled by the sex. But no, what bothered them was the fact that the book was published, even though, as they would say, even though it was written entirely in Black English, which is the language of the two people I was hoping to present.
Now, the parents were upset because they thought the novel would set a bad example, and they wanted their children to learn standard English so that they could get a better job.
Exactly. And I mean, when I was able to meet with them, they were able to see that I'm not a lunatic or anything like that. My own son at that time was very young as well, and I, you know, I'm somebody who's as concerned as any other parent, any other Black parent or whatever. But the point is that because Black English has been judged symptomatic of verbal and intellectual deficiency, Black kids going into compulsory public school situation in the United States regularly find themselves rejected whenever they open their mouths, and that they're told that the language that they bring to the school is not simply different, but that it's wrong.
Do you feel that you write in different kinds of Englishes?
Oh, absolutely. Quite consciously, I'm multilingual within what's called English. Absolutely. That has a great deal to do with the fact that my father really presented all these different kinds of English to me with equal enthusiasm or equal totalitarian demands attached. You know, that I had to be able to give back to him what would make clear my understanding of Elizabethan English when it was Shakespeare, and also give back to him evidence of my understanding of Paul Ernst Dunbar when it was that.
I'd like to ask you to read a poem now. And
okay.
This is a poem from collected in your book, Naming Our Destiny, which includes both old and new poems. This is the poem that actually ends the book. I want you to read the first part of it, and you could introduce it if you'd like.
Well, last year there was a huge memorial and reconsideration, revaluation of the war in Vietnam that was pulled together in Washington, D.C., and really centered upon the reflections of Vietnam vets. And I was invited to come and read it in that venue, and I decided to write this poem for the occasion, and this is the beginning of that poem called War and Memory. Daddy at the stove or sink, large knife nearby or artfully suspended by his clean hand, handsome even in its menace, slamming the silverware drawer open and shut. The spoons suddenly loud as the yelling at my mother, no, she would say, no, Granville, no, about, would he be late? Had she hidden away the Chinese laundry shirts again? Did she think it right that a man in his own house, should serve himself a cup of tea, a plate of food? Perhaps she thought that he should cook the cabbage and the pot roast for himself as well? It sure did seem she wanted him to lose his job because she could not find the keys he could not find. And no, she would attempt to disagree. No, Granville, no. But was he trying to destroy her with his mouth? My mouth? My daddy hunkered down, incredulous and burly now with anger. What you mean, my mouth, you woman, who you talk to in that way? I am master of this castle. Here he'd gesture with a kitchen fork around the sagging clutter, laugh and choke, the rage tears watering his eyes. You know to speak to me like that, you hear, you damn black woman. And my mother, backing up or hunching, smaller than frail bones should easily allow, began to munch on saltine crackers, let the flat crumbs scatter on her full lips and the oilcloth on the table.
The first part of this poem is about how your father beat your mother and you. I was wondering if when you were young you used to write about that and hide what you'd written.
No, I never wrote about it when I was young. when I was young, meaning, the time this poem refers to, I was about 7 or 8 years of age. The kinds of poetry I was writing was exceedingly patriotic, like Flag Day poems, and other than that, I wrote a lot of poems for money. I would write a lot of love poems for my friends, and I would charge them money depending on the length of the poem that they wanted, you know, it's like that.
That's
I
nice.
Never wrote any breaking up poems. I just wrote poems about why you should go with me, you know, it's like that kind of thing.
I guess your poems in a way served the same job that Hallmark cards do now.
Yeah, they did, actually. But I would custom make. You know, I mean, you had an advantage if you came to me because I would know who the boy was you were talking about.
That's right. Do you remember any of these poems?
No, but I remember all the boys. Actually.
In the poem that you just read, there's a line about how you used to, that when your father became abusive, you'd think about calling the police, but you hated the police.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, well, it was a little complicated. I mean, I didn't know what else to do. In those days, I mean, the concept of child abuse did not exist, you know. I just knew my father was beating the hell out of me, and I wanted some help, but I didn't know what to do. And commonly, you were supposed to call the police if you needed help. But on the other hand, because I lived in Bed-Stuy, and Bedford-Stuyvesant was like the largest black community in the country, the problem was that I also knew that when the police came in general, they didn't help, they hurt. But I did call them anyway, you know, a number of times because I needed somebody to stop my father from beating me.
And what happened when they came?
Well, they never came, was the thing. I called, but they never came, and I guess I probably sounded like what I was, a little kid on the phone, and in those days, you weren't taken seriously. If you were a little kid, I don't really know that would be so different now. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I wish I could believe it is, but I don't think so. I'm not sure at all that the police would respond in a way that meant that they took the child seriously. I don't believe that.
Mm-hmm. Your father must have been a complicated man. You know, on the one hand, he was having you read Shakespeare, and on the other hand, he was beating you.
Yeah, he was pretty complicated. I mean, I'm really glad that I survived his brutality. That wasn't clear, actually, whether it would or not, but I did, I have. And on the other hand, I think it seems to me that the good things that he was trying to do have guided my life.
Yeah. Do you ever feel that, excuse me if this is like cheap psychoanalysis, but do you ever feel that anger that was bottled up and you directed at your father has gotten channeled into politics and into writing?
Well, you know, maybe. I wouldn't say that because I didn't bottle it up. My father would hit me, and I was his daughter. I certainly hit back. But what I would say is that my father definitely taught me how to fight, and I know how to fight, and I like doing it.
Fighting for causes.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
June Jordan, thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
June Jordan recorded in 1989. She died 1 week ago after a long bout with breast cancer. This is Fresh Air.